Random Podcast with Raffy and Jando.
Alrighty, welcome back to the Random Podcast with Raffy and Chandra. This time we have a special guest, and it's Alex Ellis from Blueprint Medical. Yay! Okay, we literally spent like the last 15 minutes already on random stories, so we thought we'd better actually start before we use them all up, before the podcast even gets going. Welcome, Alex.
Yeah, thank you for having me as a guest on this. It's as we were just catching up not long ago. It's good to see you again after many years, and Chandra, obviously good to meet you. I think we've obviously spoken over the phone, but so, never met.
Alexis is somebody I think Raffy knows from a little while back, and Alex has been running Blueprint Medical, connecting a variety of different medical staff with hospitals that need some help. And he's got an especial focus at the moment on the anesthetics area. I also noticed in his he's also been helping other people connect with different jobs and also been in the police force. So a few things to chat about.
Yeah, certainly. And I think obviously we were talking about this a little bit before, but I feel like my CV is very scattergun and it's got a bit of everything in there. And I think I'm sure that for medicine and for the likes of yourselves, you tend to have a quite clearly defined path, and people maybe sometimes branch off from it. But in the world of recruitment, which obviously I'm in, you tend to find people have quite varied backgrounds, and they don't come from a normalized, you know, study route into a job. So it is quite interesting hearing about people's backgrounds. But yeah, myself, as you picked up, I studied criminology and psychology at university. Always was quite interested in criminal law. Didn't really want to do the law thing because I wasn't very good with regurgitating facts from books, and I tended to enjoy the more strategic side. So in my first year, they actually they invited Sussex Police in, and they came and did a presentation, and they invited us to apply if anyone was interested for a role as a what they call a special constable, which is a thing in the UK. I'm sure they do something similar here, but
what does it do?
So you are essentially a volunteer, so you have to do a minimum amount of hours per fortnight. It's unpaid, but you have the same police powers as a regular constable. So the only difference is you can't drive, unfortunately, the cars with the blue lights. Yeah, which is the fun part, right?
So you can't just put your pedal to the metal.
You meant to get your McDonald's run in quickly.
There's plenty of fast food in policing. That's your forte there. I did that in Brighton and Hove. So I don't know if either of you have ever been to Brighton. It's on the south coast of the UK. It's known for its stone beaches. It's a very open city. It's very mixed. It was known as the gay capital of Europe.
Is it about an hour and a bit away from London?
On the train. You can get it. You can either drive or on the train. But
secretary from work was thinking of moving back there. He's originally from London, but I was just like, come on, if you're gonna do that, you might as well go to Geelong. You know, it's an hour away.
Swap the stone for the sand.
Okay. Junk food question.
Yeah.
When you were policing, did you have an unhealthy affinity for donuts? Is The Simpsons accurate? That's what I want to know.
I think that might be a more American thing. The one thing I would say is you get insane discounts on food. It's just ridiculous.
Oh, really?
So you can. I remember when I was.
Is there like a stereotypical sort of food that is
Chinese takeaway? It was a pound a dish.
Oh wow!
Yeah, I know. And I was a student technically at the time, so I was buying enough for my whole household and bringing it all home. I think Domino's was 50% off. Nando's was probably the same, I think, from memory. So you did get a variety of perks. But you do meet some interesting people, and it's set up quite differently, I think, in the UK to perhaps how it is here. So you do neighborhood policing for the first 2 years, which is quite low level. Oh, I wouldn't say low level. It's supposed to be a softer introduction. But typically, as I'm sure you'll both attest to, public sector is a bit chaotic. So you're supposed to be aligned with a tutor for 2 years. And I came in on my first day and my tutor was nowhere to be seen, but no one had told me that she wasn't going to be in that day. She was supposed to be in. And so the sergeant just wanted rid of me, and he just put me with this chap, and he was in response, which is all the really energetic, fast-paced, driving as fast as you possibly can through the city.
McDonald's isn't going to wait for anyone.
Yeah, and that's how you get to Starbucks quickly. I was sort of walking around. I had my uniform on. It was my first shift. I was, you know, obviously you feel quite proud. You've done all the training, et cetera, et cetera. And we're knocking on a door. We did a welfare check on a lady who hadn't been seen for a while. And she came to the door. And as she comes to the door, he's talking to her. I get a buzz on my radio and it says, are you wearing your stab jacket? And so, you know, obviously I responded, yeah, affirmative kind of thing. And they were like, get in the car, go to this address right now. There's been a stabbing.
And so God,
jumped in the car. And so that all of a sudden reality kicked in a little bit. So I lost that euphoric buzz I had. And suddenly there was a little bit of worry. We turned up at this house and there's just like a group of people and just chaos. There was like blood. It was just, and then I'll never forget this, but the house had the front door open and you could see right down into the kitchen. And there was just a guy there with just two knives, just stood there, and his clothes were singed as well. He'd set himself alight, and not obviously.
Wow.
Yeah. But so the guy looked at me and he was like, just get your spray out. And he just charged full in, like, into the house and rugby tackled this guy. And so I sort of like ambling along behind him, a bit reluctant, but and then we had to bring this guy down, and he did. I mean, it was incredible how he took him down. He was very experienced, but just no fear, just went straight in. And that was kind of like,
wow.
The worst thing is it doesn't actually really stop there. So obviously then we arrested him, and it turned out it was very superficial. He'd just cut himself
across
his forearms. There was just a lot of blood. So we took him in the back of an ambulance, and they were obviously a bit worried about sitting checking him over in the ambulance. So they just said, look, you need to take him down to the station. So the way you put someone in a car is one of you sits in the back with them. So anyway, I was sat in the back with him, and obviously I didn't want to make eye contact with him. So I'm staring out the window, and I just heard this click, and he had basically, because his hands were cuffed behind his back, he just pushed the button down, and he was basically just launched him his face at my face, trying to bite me. And so I had spent the whole journey with my hand, with his head against the window. And,
was he trying to nibble on your fingers?
Oh, yeah, doing whatever he could. And, it was just, that was my first shift. It was very much like hard and fast. This is how it works. And
that deserves another round of applause.
Yeah, it was, it's an incredible, job, because you see such a variety. It's, and you know, in medicine, you'll have something similar, I'm sure. But in policing, I don't know how people keep the patience, because you tend to deal with the same people week in, week out. It doesn't really change. Yeah, you'd be surprised, because you'd assume that, you know, every day is different, but it tends to be the same families, you know, the same groups. It's just the way it is. And I think, it was interesting. I still kept with it. I stuck with it the whole way through university. And the idea was, the reason they came into our university was that they fast-tracked you to being a sergeant at the end, which is what I wanted to do. But I was, I graduated around the GFC. So initially all the public sector jobs got put on hold. My job on hold for 2 years. And in that time, I just, you know, sat around, and Brighton's not, it's not very good for jobs. It's, you know, you have to go to the Big Smoke if you want a good job. So I just said to them, I don't think I can sit around and wait. And
your first day, you were like, you know, you guys did a very good job with recruiting. Maybe I'll do that instead of tackle people who are half singed with blood pouring.
It's a bit safer, that's for sure. But no cheap takeaways. But And but yeah, so that there was, I mean, there's hundreds of stories I could tell you, but that's probably the best one because it was just the first day madness. And
that is nutty. Just yeah. Like absolutely ridiculous. That was your first day.
But yeah, so I don't think many jobs have first days like that. But my father had a brokerage, so he ran an FX brokerage, and I went and worked for him for 2 years after that, which was really good, and it was a good introduction into the workforce. He's very very much tough love, so he didn't give me a step up or anything. It was very much he threw me right in at the deep end and just gave me a very cold area that they weren't doing anything with. It was basically people paying overseas mortgages. I mean, now it would be very simple. You just do it through TransferWise or, you know, whatever people, Revolut or whatever people are using these days. But back then it was, you know, that things like that didn't exist. So essentially what I would do is I would lump all the mortgages together and purchase it as one bulk payment. And obviously, because you're doing a large sum, you get interbank exchange rate. And I would have set days where I would pay, and I'd then go out and pitch to new people to try and get them to sign up to this service. And look, it was an interesting work dynamic. It was a very male dominated floor. It was very sort
of. Was that in Brighton or was it in London?
This is actually I'm from Amersham, which is northwest of London. So it's a small market town that was set up in between Oxford and London. It was interesting. I think so. Just to cover this very quickly. So my father actually set up two companies. So I saw one fail and one succeed. So it was quite an interesting dynamic because, obviously he would leave the house at 6 a.m. every day. He would come home at 8 p.m. So I kind of got used to that when someone was working and they owned a company, they had to work exceptionally hard. And obviously I think when you watch someone and they own a company, they tend to ride a bit of a roller coaster at times. And so I saw that in the background. I think that obviously resonated with me for later in life. But
can I just ask, what were the two companies? Which one worked, which one didn't?
So one actually worked very well, but unfortunately he was one of the founders. So it was him and my uncle who founded the company, but they brought other people in, and then there was a bit of an aggressive takeover. So he ended up actually the one who exited the business, which I think recently, or as in the last 5 years, it sold for hundreds of millions. It's a massive, massive company.
Are you about to tell us what it is?
So it's a company called Currencies Direct. I'm not sure who bought them in the end, but they're global. They're in very big in Europe. They're a brokerage. And then he set up a new company called Foreign Currency Direct, it was still successful. It's just, I would say he would call an exit a failure, but maybe things just didn't quite work out. But obviously he went through a period then of not working, and it just, that impacts the home, and you kind of see the roller coaster, as I was saying, of someone who sets up a company. It's not as sweet as, say, if you work for someone else as an employee, I think you're a lot safer.
What are you saying? I thought like all the...
Seeing that, did that sort of make you more... Seeing that, you know, what it was like for your dad running businesses, did that at the time anyway make you more inclined to do that yourself? Or at the time where you're like, oh, this is a good reason not to do that?
No, I'd actually say it made me always want to set up something on my own. And I think, I think the key taught me a lot, and some of it was good, some of it bad. But I think because of his style, he taught me good work ethics. So he always made sure that I worked very hard, and he never... He would never give someone a silver spoon. He was very much like, you earn your way in life. But I think it did make me more inclined to set up on my own, obviously, when I did. But you definitely see the successes and the failures of someone going through that. It's not a clean cut journey. It's very unlikely someone ends up like the Elon Musk. You know, they don't create something that is so revolutionary that, you know, everyone knows who they are and it's smooth. And even him, if you sat with him, he would tell you, you know, it's not been easy. He's had to make sacrifices. There's been highs, lows. I think it prepared me mentally for that, and it made me more inclined to do it. And I think it made me less scared potentially, or maybe gave me the confidence that doing something like that does work out.
Well, I suppose you saw both sides, right? You saw it like work and not work, so you kind of knew that Even if it doesn't work, it's not the end of the world. Like, I think by the fact that you know, it's family, it's someone close, you could kind of, you're part of the roller coaster, not directly, but you see the highs and lows, and you can kind of see and kind of anticipate, and you realize it's not the end of the world, and Therefore maybe it takes the edge off it. I you know, don't want to be putting words in your mouth.
No. You're right. And look, as I said, it impacts the home, right? You know, things like, you know, school fit, because I'm one of five as well. So it was like, you know, my dad had, you know, seven mouths to feed. So, it, you know, that didn't change, but didn't change overnight, you know. And then when you're not working and you've got that happening, and you've got to pick yourself back up, I think I watched him do that. And I think he obviously went through a lot to do it. And I think I saw how he motivated himself. It was just quite an interesting thing to watch. And I don't think, most people, they set up a business and it tends to be quite successful, but to jump out of one and then set up a new one and, you know, and have to go through that same process from scratch again. And he had that business for 20 years. He sold it, I don't know, 3-4 years ago now. And they've got bought by private equity, and they since rebranded, and, but it's doing very well. You know, I think he took it to a certain level, and then they came in, and that's probably what was needed at the time.
Yeah, so he was happy to have exited at that point.
Yeah, I think he was done by that point. Yeah,
I hope he got a good exit and he's like hanging out on a beach somewhere, because it sounds like he deserves it.
Yeah, I think he might be. Yeah, but yeah. So then,
unless he's on to starting something, yeah,
might be meeting you, Chandra, on your travels. But yeah. So then, following that, I wanted to go and work in London. I had a few friends that had done the same, and I think it's generally the standard thing people do in you know, in the UK. So
my brother's over there now. There you go. So it's not just the UK. It seems to be a global appeal.
Yeah. And look, it's a great city, and I mean, it's consuming in the good ways, but it's good when you're in your early 20s or mid 20s, and you know, you're just kind of figuring things out. And I think people tend to move back to where I grew up as they get a bit older, and you know, don't necessarily want the best bars and pubs and things like that on their doorstep. I applied for some broking jobs in London, and ended up getting picked up by a company called Michael Page, which is they're a FTSE 250, so they're one of the biggest recruitment companies in the world. They were set up in 1976. I think they've got over 140 offices, probably over 10,000, maybe even more staff. But again, this was all kind of around the time of the GFC, so everything was just starting to pick back up. And so they actually brought me in to recruit into their front office market risk and quant analyst area, which I didn't study business or economics, so I had no clue what quants did. I don't know if you guys
might know us because we don't. I was like, those are words that I have heard said. I have no meaning attached to any of them.
Basically, they build all the mathematic models for trading within investment banks, or you know, the weigh up risk. So things like value at risk, and if you the market risk is the big one. Well, was the big one at the time, because obviously it was based around, you know, what impacts the market could have on trades. Even things like derivatives, I hadn't even, like, I'd studied business studies at school, but I hadn't heard the word for so long. So I was kind of thrown very much into the deep end.
This is all Chandra's territory. This is what he lives for.
out of curiosity, was the business exploring those areas so they could work out what to focus on in terms of recruitment, like which sort of areas to focus, or for actual
training itself? It was actually to support demand. So they have a big city office in London in Aldermanbury Square, which is right in between sort of Barbican and Moorgate. And they have a few panel clients, like places like Deutsche Bank and things like that. And all of these banks at that time, they were going out, and risk was this big buzzword. And they were just going out trying to build risk teams. And there was a team that did credit risk, I did market risk, and then focus on quants. So you get middle office quants who basically they sort of review things after the fact, and then the front office worked with the trading teams at the time. So, you know, and these guys, I know you mentioned coding earlier, but these guys, you know, that's what they live and breathe. They're just coding it day in, day out. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, how did you find adapting to that, considering that's not like... You're riding around to a stabbing like 10 minutes ago. now you've gone through from like, hey, let's package up mortgages for cheaper exchange rates, to now there's a guy in an office coding up some stuff and you're managing the risk. Like, how did you find adapting to all that?
It was definitely a tough gig. And it was something that even now I look back on, and I would approach it very differently now. But obviously I was still quite young, and I think just the types of people that then, you know, inevitably they're, you know, PhDs generally from Oxford, Cambridge, they're very, very introverted. They don't have a lot of social skills. So it's very hard to narrow down on how good they are. So it's not like, you know, you and I can speak, and less so in medicine, but you and I can speak, and I can kind of determine how likely you are to fit in a certain role. Whereas with something like that, it was very hard to judge someone, and you had to really sort of work on drawing them out a little bit and finding out what they've actually done. And then,
can I just ask, like, you know, they approach, like, you know, you're applying for staff when you want to work in London. Why did they specifically, like, you know, your background is, I suppose you had psychology in it. Is that what made you a fit for the company? Like,
because... Yes, generally speaking, this is what I was sort of saying at the start, is recruitment doesn't have a clearly defined path. So they look for someone with social skills, who is driven, who is likely to... one, work well in the area they are. So, you know, if you're a high volume person, you tend to sort of gravitate towards the areas like you could do something like office support potentially, or, you know, something that's very high volume. You'd work with a lot of clients, and it'd be, or on big contracts, like big public contracts. And whereas I think what they had seen at that time, I think they thought that I could adapt into that world. Also, I had a boss who had worked in product control, which again is another area of investment banking. So I think they thought alongside him, he would teach me, you know, the ropes essentially in terms of recruitment, plus the lingo and the technicalities of investment banking. Problem was, he left after 3 months, which that was kind of my...
At least he turned up on the first day, hopefully.
Never no knives as well. So.
Hopefully he turned up on the first day, at least, you know, to start.
So
so it sounds like they sort of hired you for your social skills and ability to work with people. And was this a particular role that you were specifically looking for, or is it just sort of, you know, was the opportunity available?
I mean, probably more so that they spun it in a way that put my interest. So initially, I was looking at broking roles, you know, continue the same path. But I quite liked the change, and I'd actually, I went traveling in between. So I was I was a bit more refreshed. You know, when you have a bit of a break, you don't mind trying something new. You feel like you can give something new a good start. And I applied to a job with them, and they flipped it and asked me to chat to them, which they do quite often if they think someone might work on their side. And it was a really good team. They were super intelligent people. There was lots of ex-lawyers, ex-bankers. So they actually generally hired people who had experience in the field they were working in.
What made it so enticing for you? Like, what did they do to change the role so that you're like, oh yeah, that sounds...
I mean, they definitely carry a prestige. And as I said, you know, they're one of the first recruitment companies ever. They started off in the city in London doing accounting recruitment. They know their stuff. They're, you know, and I've met, you know, through my walks of life there, I met some incredible people. But they did a really good sell. There was just the people I met were all slick, impressive. There was no one who, you know, there was no dud. Everyone was very, very switched on. And they kind of blew me away a little bit with that sort of stuff. It was every interviewer was just, you know, so switched on. They were challenging me in ways I hadn't ever been challenged before. It was really interesting. And they did quite a good sell on, you know, risk. And as I said just earlier, if I approached it now, I'd do it very differently. I think I had a very good opportunity there. I just don't think I realized it at the time. I was young, I was less experienced, you know, in a different ballpark now. But
if you'd done things differently, would you be on this podcast?
What do you mean by that in terms of you'd do it different? I was going to say, what do you mean by you'd do it differently?
Back then, I second guessed myself a lot. I wasn't quite confident enough to believe in the decision I'd made. And I think that comes with experience and. I think, you know, as I was saying, once my boss left it, I didn't really have anyone to show me. So I was almost a bit self-taught. And because of that, I doubted myself a little bit. And look, they were really good to me. They gave me exceptional training. My boss there was probably a chap called David Leithead, who's now actually the COO of another company. He was one of the best trainers I've ever had in any job. He was a really, really good trainer, leader. So it was a great team, but I think what I would do now would be totally different. I actually think I would, and this sounds very arrogant, but I think I would do it very well now because I think I'd have the confidence, I'd have the know-how, I'd be a lot slicker myself.
I think, like, from what you've also said, it's like you've done this little zigzag, right? Like, and you've just kind of zigged into this other role that was kind of not what your area was, and you're young. And it's, I suppose, especially if you see a team like that, it'd be like, I mean, the way you're describing it, I'm like, yep, I would totally second guess myself if everyone else was super slick. And I'm like,
yeah,
the guy who was meant to support me is gone. I think it's option C, but I'm not sure, but maybe C.
And that's it. I think, being around people like that, it definitely helped and it hindered me because, as I said, they were all so intelligent. Everyone was, you know, just smooth operators, very successful. But yeah, it taught me a lot. And look, they, you know, they had great training. And fortunately, from there, I actually then moved to Australia. So they, you know, they have international offices, and they were very good about allowing me to move offices after 2 years. And then I transferred to Sydney. So, you know, I wouldn't
have... What made you do that? Like, you know, people talk about visiting Australia. Very few people go, I'll go live there after hearing about the snakes and spiders and sharks. Yeah,
I mean, there was a couple of things really. So one, I'd always wanted to live overseas. It was always grand ambition, no matter what. So even when I was looking at the policing side or criminology, I was already thinking about where, like, how I could apply that somewhere else.
Don't most people in the UK just go across the river to, like, France or somewhere local instead of going to the other side of the planet?
Yeah, that was too easy. My two were either
or
the
US Perth. There's a lot of Australia. There's a lot of people from the UK.
Sorry,
here.
Chandra.
Sorry, Chandra.
And I was just going to say, there's a lot of people from the UK that end up here in Perth as well.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think, look, Australia is obviously the far away land for us that carries an air of mystery, but is actually, you know, very similar to the UK. I think people definitely have a different style here that took me a little bit of time to get used to. I think the humour is slightly different, and I thought that was like the big culture shock was people were very direct, and I wasn't quite sure, because in the UK people are almost slightly apologetic when they shouldn't be. I don't know if you've ever heard this before, but you know, they'll squeeze past someone and say sorry as if, you know, they're in the way, even though they're the one trying to get around the person who's blocking the you know, the sidewalk. It was either the US or Australia, and look, I picked Australia, and transferred out with Michael Page to the office here in Sydney.
And was Australia just because of the opportunity of Australia versus the US,
or something particular that made you pick Sydney? And look, they obviously said it was a great place to live, and I think the US obviously carries a bit of stigma, like, you know, I think it's obviously very big. You'd have to pick a, you know, a city, and it's a bit more of an unknown. I felt like Australia, you know, I'd actually never been, but so I rocked up, got off the plane, and, you know, was surprised by when I arrived in the middle of winter and wasn't expecting it to be as cold as it was, but within a week it had shot up to about 28 degrees every day. So it was like summer. Yeah, it was just very alien to me, but I think it's a great place, and it's obviously held in high regard by a lot of Brits, and you know, I think I think it made sense to move over at that time, and I'm now this will be my 10th year, so I've obviously not regretted it.
Fair enough. Well, you are Aussie now, right?
Yeah. I've got the passport at least. So yeah.
I think Chandra's dropped off for a second. He's been having connection issues, but anyway, welcome back, Chandra. So you went from that company I met you when I was locuming, I think, as a registrar. Was that for the same company, or was
no? So I was just saying to Chandra that I moved with Michael Page. So then I recruited accountants in Australia, and it was a totally different market. It was people just. I think the good thing about Aussies is they like the underdog, and they like giving you a go. And I think as long as you don't let them down, you generally make inroads. The UK was quite a harsh market. You know. You'd call people up and it wouldn't be unheard of to be sworn at. And, you know, it was a bit more cutthroat, a bit more ruthless. And I think, whereas Aussies were a bit more welcoming. And I found I flipped quite quickly into that world and actually did quite well in accounting in Australia. I did that for a couple of years. It was all contract work. So that's where I started to work in this contract world where things move very quickly. So the difference really between the two is when you work in permanent recruitment, you're interested in like the why, you know, why someone wants to do something, you know, why they might move, why would they pick that location. With temp, it's more about when. It's just, you know, when can you work? It's very quick, and you kind of work people out very quickly, and you have to be very adaptable. And I don't know why, but I think from some of the jobs I've done, I got used to moving quite quickly between people, but retaining that data, you know, and you have to have very good recall when you work in a temp desk, because, you know, you might speak to someone for 10 minutes, but you need to know as much as you can in that 10 minutes about them. But I met, so I had a friend of mine called Michael who worked for one the agency that I worked in after that. So that was Global Medic. So he had worked there for I think 7 or 8 years. And so Michael moved over from their UK office. Him and I had gone to primary school together and also secondary school. And we were just playing golf one day and very badly, mind. I don't know if either of you play, but I'm terrible.
No, very badly.
I went to a driving range once, right?
Yeah.
And the guy, like, you know, we're just hitting balls, right? So there was once, this was my third shot ever. The guy's like, yeah, you know, you just swing. It doesn't matter. Just see how far you go. I hit the ball. It hit the roof. It landed behind me. So he's like, well, that's never happened before.
You say that. I've done the same thing. So yeah, I think we must be similar ability. But yeah.
Negative handicaps. Like, I should be winning if I rock up.
Yeah, yeah. Going backwards. But yeah, so I was playing golf with Michael. And look, I'd spent a couple of years with Michael Page, sorry, in Australia. And he was working at Global Medics at the time. And, you know, we sort of talked about some opportunities there. And then I interviewed with them. And yeah, when I joined, it was just on sort of the upscale. So they were still fairly small-ish, but they had started to hire some people. And they actually got sold to an English company. So I joined in April 2015. They got sold that year. So by June, they'd actually sold the company. So I actually watched a company go through a sale whilst being in it, which is a very unusual experience. And you see a lot of things happen around you, and then they start making sense, and then you sort of join the dots together. So I started working with anaesthetists, and you're probably going to hate me for saying this, Rafi, but I found the anaesthetists similar to the investment bankers as they in terms of intelligence. And then I felt like they had all the personality. So the quants.
Whoa. We're not the personable.
That sounds
we put
right.
You to sleep. there's like 5 minutes of personality. That's all I can manage. After that, there's awkward silences, pauses, and do you like Pokemon cards?
you wait till you meet a quant and then you'll be blown away. But yeah, so I found that the anaesthetists were a lot very easy to get on with. I think the thing about anaesthetists is that they just want all the information up front, and they just want the honest truth. And I think as long as you are, you know, you're always honest and you work in a certain way, I think you generally get on quite well with them. And I've generally got on pretty well with everyone I've worked with, and, you know, obviously been lucky enough, Rafi, to hang out with you as well. So, you know,
it's been years, I think, since we first chatted, right? Like, 20. When did you say you moved? It would have been pretty much soon.
Yeah, 2015. Yeah, so it would have been around that sort of time, I'm sure.
Because, yeah, I was just senior reg starting fellowship.
Yeah. And that's the part of it that I really enjoy, is you get to see people through their career and you watch them. And again, it, you know, not too dissimilar from what I was saying about myself in Michael Page, is you watch them sort of start out and then maybe not quite sure of themselves, but have the potential. And then you start seeing them become the person they are. And then, you know, then they're a fully fledged boss. And, you know, all of a sudden, they're sort of the one that's being looked up to by the new doctors you're trying to get on board. And it's a really interesting field. And, you know, I was lucky enough that, you know, I managed eventually ICU and surgery as well. But I always stuck with anaesthetics. So, you know, I really, really enjoyed it. And I think, you know, I went to the conferences and used to go down to hospitals and do presentations. I do less of that now, obviously, running a company. But I really put myself out there. I realized that it was a great opportunity. And, you know, I actually really enjoyed it. And so it was nice to find something quite refreshing.
Two questions about all that. Firstly, you seem to have gone through a bit of a zigzaggy arc prior. Then you got to recruitment and then you kind of stopped and said, this is it. What about recruitment did that? Like, as in, and the second thing is going to be, at what point during Global Medics you were like, yeah, look, great, but I'm going to do it myself with my own company, right? Those are my two questions.
I think I got to the point where it was probably, for me, it was when I moved to Australia. So once I moved to Australia, and because I had some doubts about myself in London, because like I said, it was a tough gig. It was a GFC. I think once things started to click together and I realized, oh, it's not necessarily me, it's the way I'm approaching things, and I changed my approach. And, you know, again, I had a good boss in Sydney who helped me do that. And once the pieces of the puzzle started fitting in. I actually really enjoyed it. And I think for me, the medical world was really interesting. It was, you know,
stabbings and blood every day.
It's probably safe there. But I just, yeah, I seem to just really fall into it. And when, as I said with the anaesthetist particularly, I just seem to, like, I'm a bit of a closet nerd. So, I like nerdy things. And I think I could actually be myself for once and around people that are probably quite similar to that. And I think
there's nothing closet nerdy about any of us. We are hardcore, full-on nerd. And thank you for the compliment before about social skills.
But like I said, if you meet a quant, you'll know. You won't meet them in a bar, that's for sure.
Can I just say, are they like this? If you were to leave them somewhere and come back 12 hours later, they'd be still in front of a computer?
Probably.
That's Chandra. We have cornered him. So one day, because he was my housemate for many years, and I'm sure I've said this in the podcast, where I was going to work, and he's like, it was my dining table was his, you know, desktop. And I left, and I came back.
The living room.
And I came back, and it was dark, right? All the lights were off, and he's staring at this computer screen. He's like, weren't you going to work? I'm like, yes, 12 hours ago. And he's like, oh, it's dark. I should eat.
What can I say? Sometimes you get addicted to something. I was, actually. I think that time was not quant stuff, but yes, close enough.
If you talk about models and not good ones, then I know what you're talking about.
Funny enough, I do have a whole set of those. Awesome.
But so I think things just kind of fit in, and look, I stayed there for a while, and I then met my now wife Michelle in New York when I was on holiday, and it was just at the point when I was starting to going back to what we were talking about earlier, Chandra, as well, you know, starting to think, I always want to do something on my own. This is something I'm enjoying. Mm. This is the kind of thing I can see myself doing. And so I actually made the decision to leave. And at that point, I hadn't set anything up. I wasn't, I wasn't quite sure what I was going to do, but I knew I wanted to do something. And, in my travels, I got in touch with Michael, and he was kind of feeling the same way. He was obviously still employed, but we agreed to sort of do some conferences online, and you know, just maybe throw some ideas around. And he actually brought someone else in, so there were three of us initially, and we just sort of said that we felt that the way locum agencies were going wasn't what we wanted, and we wanted to go back to, you know, the strategy, the working with hospitals, and working with the doctors as well, in the way we enjoyed. And I think, you know, inevitably as companies get bigger, things get lost, you know, et cetera. Just the
culture. What was the big thing that was kind of made you unhappy? Like, what were you guys trying to do differently to the existing model?
Just more like relationship driven, I think, is the key part of it. So, you know, I think, and I'm trying to say this in a way where I don't come across as bitter, but I think when companies get bigger, they can't maximize on the things that people value. And both internally and externally, because they become so big that there's just layers, and, you know, it just doesn't quite work in the same way. And we, you know, I've used the word slick a few times, but we wanted to be a slick operation that, really got down to the mechanics of a hospital. And one of my favorite times of work was when I was working a lot with, like Wagga Base, and, you know, working with the director one-on-one, you know, planning each week, I felt like I was actually doing something that was making a bit of a difference. And that was probably the most exciting part for me. And, and then there were other places I was working with as well. And I just thought, you know, this is a part I'm enjoying. I'm probably going to lose that if I move up through the echelons a bit. And at that time, you know, like I said, I just met Michelle, and I was thinking, you know, I want to have the freedom to move around, and, you know, to set up a company and say, right, I want an office in the UK or the US, and be the one driving those decisions, not sitting back and having them made for me. And So yeah, we set up Blueprint in 2019. So it was a year before, you know, COVID and what have you. And yeah, look, it was three of us. We had very humble beginnings. We rented an office. We rented some desks off one of my friends who ran a charity platform, and he just had some spare desks, and he just gave us some desks and charged us very, very nominal rent and said, away you go.
And it looks like you had the blueprint.
It was actually Michelle who came up with that name, which she's got a background in writing, so she's written a couple of books, and so she's quite good with words and marketing and things like that. So yeah, that was where the name came from, though. It was like looking at the mechanics of a hospital and working with them to forward plan and that kind of thing. And then obviously Blueprint is where I'm now. So we started off just the three of us. We hired our first staff member in 2020 in February, and then quickly went into lockdown after that. Then we hired actually two people in. So I actually got married in, I think I might have told you this actually, Rafi, but I got married in March 2020 on the 14th of March in LA.
Okay.
And so we'd obviously had the wedding planned, and we got married, and on the day of the wedding, we had people coming in from the UK and obviously the US and Australia, but people were getting phone calls to say, you know, get on a plane now, this is the last one back to the UK or wherever it was. So we went to bed that night not really knowing what was going to happen. I woke up in the middle of the night with a fever, and so we were just like, well, kind of, what do we do from here? So we pushed our flight, but I called Qantas the next day and just said, you know, look, obviously we can't travel. And they pushed our flight back by 2 weeks, and they said, you have to get on that flight. It's the last possible flight back to Australia. And we don't know when the next one will be. So long story short, we got on this plane. There was all dramas getting Michelle on, 'cause she didn't have a visa at the time, because she was on a bridging partner visa. And the guy took pity on us and actually let her board the flight, which apparently, you know, it could have gone either one of two ways. But we were the first plane to be put in hotel quarantine.
Not realize.
Yeah. So we were in part of a massive queue. By the time we got off and got our luggage, we were just part of a massive queue, and people were just put on buses, and it was very surreal. You didn't quite know what to expect, and they had made the decision the night before, so we didn't even know what we were. So we'd read the news the night before, got on a plane the next morning, and just had no idea what we were walking into. And
so you're in a tiny room. When you first get there, because I imagine if you're the first guinea pig, what's happening? No one knows, including you.
It was no one knew. Even the people that worked, or you know, the people that were drafted in to help, a lot of them were, you know, the reserves and you know, the police. They just had no clue. They were just told to shepherd us onto these coaches. So we were in the line to get into the Hilton, and there was probably about 40 coaches ahead of us, and it was just, you know, it wasn't moving. So someone came on and said, put them in the Grand Hyatt. So we went into the Hyatt Regency, so we went there, and for 2 weeks. So you're just, they literally put you in, they don't give you a key, they lock the door. And then there was a police officer sat outside on a chair, and they would obviously rotate, and you're just, that's it for 2 weeks.
Could have said, I have been a police officer, let me sit in the chair.
I would have got the cheap food, right? I should have got the takeaways. I don't know why they weren't offering them out at that point, but they could have made a good business, you know. But
yeah, there you go.
So it was a really surreal experience. But then so I had to still work. So I was just sat on my laptop on this.
What a honeymoon you had.
Yeah, I know.
I was kind of curious to ask you about, like, I mentioned opening a business just before COVID would be interesting.
A recruitment business, no less.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, where usually you travel to go to your locum.
Yeah, well, there were things constantly changing, and new rules were being put in place. Hospitals weren't really sure what to do. They weren't, the communication was decided at federal level, then it wasn't filtering down to the state correctly. And it look, it was a nightmare to manage. But look, we had a pretty solid group and we just got on with it. And we knew we weren't going to change things. We just had to cope. And, you know, again, we were talking earlier about, you know, the roller coaster and of running a business. It was very much, you know, there was all of a sudden this uncertainty, but all we knew was we had to keep the lights on. And, you know, we were just working. And look, fortunately, we'd done a lot of groundwork the year before, which had helped, you know, coming into 2020. And people still were pretty good about it. I think, look, the doctors were, you know, the ones that were working with us, they still stuck with it. They just got used to being a bit more adaptable. And I think everyone was quite forgiving. And, you know, fortunately, I think, you know, things still worked out. I remember I actually interviewed two staff that ended up working with us whilst sat in my hotel room. You know, I had to be on my laptop interviewing them. So I had never met them when they started. You know, it was a really crazy experience because obviously you normally screen people when you meet them and, you know,
imagine it would have been a bit of a different experience for you because most recruitment and it's a relationship building game that you're in.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a different medium.
Yeah. And it took, you know, your most powerful tool away, really, you know, your ability to network and go out and do things and look.
But you had Zoom filters. You could have worn the shades. You could have had the whiskers. One more personality.
You can tell people that you're not a cat.
Yeah, and there's probably a video somewhere of us circulating of me with a, you know, a cat hat on or something, you know. But yeah, I mean, look, it was an interesting time, and one fortunate thing, and I think, you know, we can all agree that this does help, is that, you know, public health is always at the forefront of, you know, any economy. And I think during a recession, it is not recession proof, it's still protected a little bit, whereas, you know, things like banking, I'm sure, weren't as ring fenced, and I saw that in my, you know, my previous job. So, mm-hmm. You know, there was a reason healthcare was very stable, and, you know, as I said, people were very adaptable, and, you know, they just coped. And the company started growing quite well, and we hired a few more staff, and we hired three more people in October. So we got up to just under 10 by the end of 2020, which was really impressive. And then obviously, you know, things are still going very well. So the company's grown to 18. We'll be 21 in a few months' time. So we've got a few more people joining, and we're covering all the major pillars. So, you know, general practice, emergency medicine, general medicine, anaesthetics, ICU. You know, so everything is covered, and we tend to just align one person to each area so that they're not dabbling in different things. And, you know, myself, I'm still, you know, very involved in anaesthetics, but do a bit of surgery these days and a bit of ICU as well. But you know, obviously my network is very strong in anaesthetics, and that's where I've now been in anaesthetics for 8 years. So, you know,
and you guys were sponsoring one of my registrars.
Oh yeah, really?
Well, Amran.
Oh yeah, Amran. Oh yeah, 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 yeah. We've been, you know, we've been very fortunate. I've worked with people like Rafi, and he's obviously sent me, you know, the registrars underneath him over the years, and it's so relationship driven. The whole hospital world is. Everyone knows everyone. There's, you know, like 2 degrees of separation to everyone. You know, you can, and I think because of that, our style of working has always been very professional. So we've always done well out of, you know, our networks, and, you know, the company's very strong at the moment, which is good. But we definitely not finished the journey. And I think, you know, that's the key part of this for me, I think, was from what I've seen in the past, I've realized that, your goal can change, but, you know, you have to have a goal in mind. And I think, you know, as I've got a bit older, obviously my goals changed a little bit. It's no longer about, you know, I think we were talking a little bit about Wagga before. And, you know, when I was covering their account previously, I used to stay up till midnight filling their shifts. You know, I'd be working things out, it was like a chessboard. I'd be moving things around, and whereas nowadays, you know, obviously I'd love to say I'm up till midnight every day, but I value my own time a little bit, and I've got people working for me, so it's, you know, their job to fill those shoes a little bit.
One thing I remember you mentioning is, you know, the difficulty of scaling a company, and, you know, as you get bigger, then it becomes much more difficult to maintain that relationship, personal touch. Mm-hmm. It sounds like, you know, going to 18, you're starting to get to a pretty big team. How have you found managing that sort of growing pain as you go?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. I think really the good thing about when you're the owner and running a business is that you actually care and can create the culture. And I think that's one thing in some of the other businesses I worked in. You never really saw the owner, and the culture was just given to you on a plate or, you know, a sheet of paper. And it was like, these are our values. This is what we stand for. And I think, you know, we've always stood by sort of working for long-term future and long-standing relationships. And I think, you know, myself and Michael, who's the other co-founder, we're still very heavily involved in our area. So he's worked in obstetrics for over 10 years. And I think from that, we're still so finger on the pulse that we're leading by example more than, you know, more than other companies are potentially. And look, maybe to our detriment at times, because it's obviously hard to juggle leading a business, managing a business. And, you know, I think one of the big learnings for me has been the shift from being an employee to a leader. And, you know, especially things that you never think about as an employee are very important as a leader. And, you know, I think it's now something I've invested 4 years of my life. And as we've been talking about, you know, you can see, and I was a little bit jumpy at a point. This is probably my most steady job now. So, you know, obviously we care, and it's, you know, it's now something that I've put a lot of blood, sweat and tears in. And I think, look, there is a point, and I don't think we'd ever want to get, there's a difference between being the biggest and being the best. And I've always said that I'd rather be the best than the biggest, because that's what drives me. It's not, I don't want to turn around to someone and say, you know, we're a 100-person company. I want to say, you know, we're 20 and we're the best you'll ever find. And, you know, and to actually believe it as well. You know, and at the moment, you know, I can stand by these things. And, you know, I want to make sure that the new generation of people are trained correctly. And, you know, we're investing a lot this year back into the company and into the staff. And I think, you know, one thing that we want to make sure is that those staff carry the same values that we do, and they lead by example for the newer generations. But look, I think, to answer your question again, I think, you know, when you're a leader, the strategy has to be underpinned to something else. And look, any of my staff could leave tomorrow, and I have to make sure I have the capacity to cover the clients, because obviously the hospitals matter. And, you know, if someone walks away, it's even in myself, I know this sounds very morbid, but, you know, if I got struck by a bus tomorrow, there's got to be someone ready to step into my shoes so that the service doesn't suffer. And when you're a leader, your thinking becomes around that. It's okay, strategic planning. And
how you guys approach, because a couple of questions from that. Yeah. It's like, first of all, it's like, you kind of, it sounds like you launched in the most inopportune time for a business, but you still made it work. You're in a good, stable platform. What is the blueprint vision, and what is it that, like, I mean, you've kind of half answered it, which is you're trying to be the best in terms of personal life, but what's the long-term vision of it? And the other part of it is, would you not say that if you and your co-founder are so heavily involved, that is the bottleneck? Like, as in, you can only scale so far when there's two people that are driving it all, and what are you doing? And third, do you guys have, like, you know, every hospital has, like, this is our mission statement and this is our values, and they have usually, like, I think Southern Health is like, I care, and this, that, and they've got a little mnemonic. Do you guys have one?
Oh, yeah. these are all the things that when I was an employee I would see, and I just think, oh, you know, why do people bother? But Ours were professionalism, expertise, people. So, you know, obviously, we as I said before, we want to be a professional outfit. We want to, you know, we want to feel people to feel like we're experts in our field. But the one conundrum we've had recently, and something that we've been, you know, we've been talking about, myself and Michael, is how do we take ourselves out of the picture without impacting the business? And it becomes a very difficult question to answer, because look, and this is business, right? You ride a roller coaster. You might take yourself out and it impacts the revenue, but it might be better in the long run. It might make, you know, the business might actually be suffering from a lack of your time and a lack of your leadership. And so there is a fine line. And I think, you know, I was interviewing someone the other day and I was talking about this, but I think we had our initial growth stage, which was obviously hiring people, bringing them in. And I feel like now we're at a reinvestment stage, I call it, which is where we're training staff. We're like getting external trainers in. We're trying to build the next layer of people to step into our shoes. You know, myself, I hired a girl from Ireland who had recruited anaesthetists and surgeons for 4 years. And I'm slowly starting to train her up to look. And, you know, I'm a bit of a control freak, so I'd probably struggle to completely give everything up. But the idea is we're starting to work towards covering ourselves. But it's a fine line in business. And I think, you know, especially when you've worked from the bottom up, there is a point where you have to step back, and it might impact the bottom line. But these are all the things I've been learning as a business owner. It's just such a different world. It's not as easy as people think it is. And there's, you know, as you said, we've had our own challenges, some of in our control, some of completely out of our control. But I think as long as the reason you're there every day doesn't change and you don't doubt it, then it still works. It's the second you start not believing in something, you start to see the cracks appear. And yeah, I've obviously ridden the roller coaster, but I've never had the doubts.
What's the long-term vision then of Blueprint? Like, you guys have basically got locums covered. And well, I mean, the reason you're on the podcast is, of the many years of locuming here and there, I think you're the only person I've kept in contact with from that locuming world.
Yeah.
So like, in terms of building a relationship, like, it's not often that you have a recruiter as a saved number on your phone, but I do. Yeah. Course.
And look, that, you know, that's kind of, that's why we're still doing it. You know, I love that. I love the fact that you can even say that. And for me, that, you know, that, as sad as it sounds, that keeps, you know, that keeps me going. It's, you know, and I've enjoyed getting to know the people I have. But in terms of our vision, I think, so for myself and Michael, look, obviously there's, so we're currently just based in Australia and New Zealand. You know, as I mentioned earlier, Michelle's American. So the US is a market we've got an eye on. Obviously, doing more with the UK, Ireland. We already do a little bit with Ireland, but doing more with the UK and Ireland and having established offices there. You know, we've been talking about maybe setting up a business, bringing staff in for us from the UK to work for our business here in Australia, and, you know, maybe trying to set up a way that people can move a bit more freely, a bit like what, you know, what I did with Michael Page. You know, and there's a few sort of business ideas. And as I said, you know, the journey really for us is still, we're still in embryonic stages. I think technically New South Wales class is a startup as anything up to 5 years, and we'd be, you know, just over 4 years now. So we're still essentially a startup, but yeah, the journey won't stop, but it might, the reasoning might change. So as I was saying earlier, for myself, it's become less about, you know, flogging myself to just, I was just trying to earn as much money as I humanely could. And I'm sure, as, you know, medical practitioners yourselves, you know, after studying for many years, you've probably found that, you know, there's a draw to start kind of putting yourself through as much work as possible when you first get your letters.
Our last episode was on burnout, so I feel like it's very appropriate for you to say that.
Rafi's just stepped down from 7 days a week of work to 6 days. So, you know.
Hey, it's been 3 months of 6 days. I don't know what to do with this.
Wow.
But it's not uncommon.
So light.
You know, it's really not uncommon. And I don't know, look, I can obviously only talk about anesthetics, really, and surgery, but people seem to get their letters and then just go full guns blazing into, you know, more and more work. And, you know, I think, there has to be a point where you take your foot off the gas. And look, as much as I would love to say that I could operate at that capacity, I think I've learned a lot about my own limitations. And I really pushed myself to the limit in my last job. I really worked myself to the point where, probably, you know, similar to what you're talking about, burnout there, you know, sleepless nights for, you know, consecutively for 3 months at a time, you know. And, you know, I've actually had this a little bit recently as well, where I've been waking up at 1 a.m. and thinking about all the things I didn't do in the day that I said I was going to. And, I think, look, we have to recognize when we get to that point, it's probably enough. And so I'm a little bit better these days at realizing when I'm getting to that point. And I'm probably a bit more focused on myself as an individual. Like, I did something really random last year. I basically signed up and did an amateur boxing fight just for a bit of a, you know, something.
I saw this on Instagram and yeah. I was like, okay, I didn't know he was into that.
Yeah. So it was kind of something that came out of, so unfortunately we went through a shareholder dispute last year so there were three founders with obviously now just two of us, but during that time, I needed like a bit of a distraction.
A literal punching bag.
so basically, I signed up to this. It was like one of those 12 weeks, and then you have a proper fight. And I've heard the saying before. It's a Mike Tyson saying, but the one that everyone has a plan until they're punched in the face. And honestly, getting hit week in, week out, and the training was grueling, but it was so good. And I've kept it up actually, but it was so good for me at that time. And it taught me to focus more on myself. And yeah, look, boxing is, as I always say, it's like a chess game with your face. So it's very it's very tactical.
What, like, do you do an L-shaped move with your face to try and be the knight?
Knight to
knight to right punch.
Yeah. I think like I was saying, as I've got a bit more mature and maybe a bit more understanding of where I'm at mentally and, you know, how work's impacting me, things like that have been a good distraction. And I think that, you know, my advice to anyone in employment really is, and this goes for, you know, just anyone, even, you know, a grad is like, make time for yourself. And I think we definitely noticed a bit of a culture shift with the workforce in the last 2 years, where people don't necessarily want to work themselves to, you know, to the level I was talking about earlier. You know, they want the lifestyle.
Definitely a shift. Like, I mean, you know, like, part of the thing, the reason we were talking about in the last podcast about the burnout stuff was like, there was this very sudden phase shift, I think, that COVID brought on. Like, there was that intense pressure of the pandemic and everything else, and then people kind of went the other way and they're like, look, balance is important. But in the meantime, there are all these shifts and lists that are unfilled. And yeah. Like, I was filling a lot of them, and that's where I was burning out, because I was like trying to keep things going until, I don't know, like, things went back to normal. But I think we're just in a new normal, and that's the way it is.
The new normal is something we've definitely heard a lot in our line of work. And I think the one thing I've noticed is the junior doctors are a lot more inclined to take time off, be more flexible. So I used to work with some people who would take time off to do the part one or the part two. And, you know, in this day and age now, I have, you know, in double digits, you know, sometimes up to 20 people doing that at any one time. And look, it's obviously a big impact to their study, their work, you know, and their finance, you know.
Genuinely, I can honestly hand on heart say this, the part two, I had one exam left in me, and the health repercussions for that is still with me. Like, it's like, what, 10 years down the track or something. Like, it is not a fun time. Like, it's like, all you do is you go to work, you come home. Like, the thing I always say is, like, once it's done, right, I remember after the exam, you find out on the day whether you passed or not. So around the corner from the college, there's like some pub or something. I don't drink, but I was there with my Diet Coke. And I realized like after the first hour of, you know, everyone going, what did you answer for this question and the other? There was like this dead silence. And I'm like, guys, we're done with the exam, right? Like, you know, we should be like, chatting and happy. And then I went to ask, like, it's like, oh, so what have you been up to? Then I was like, oh, this is why everyone's silent. Everyone knows. We've been all like, everyone sits in their study groups. Everyone's seen each other for the past maybe 6, if not 12 months. We've seen each other at work. We've gone home for dinner. Then we've come back to the library and we've rinsed and repeated. So yeah. No one has anything new to say. Everyone knows exactly where the other people have been. They've been in the same library just across the road. They're just either giving you the Viber or you're giving them the Viber. And it's just like after 12 months of that, it's just not fun.
Yeah, I've definitely
outside
seen
that exam sort of setting, Alex. Have you noticed that the pattern of people are doing locum work or, you know, working with you has changed either at the junior doctor level or at the senior level?
I think because rates have changed. So I think for yourself, Rafi, when you were doing them, I don't know if you're still sort of picking them up, the emails and things like that, but the rates
still get your emails, yeah.
Yeah, the rates have gone up to, you know, 50%, sometimes 100% more than they were, you know, prior to COVID. And especially, you know, that junior doctor market, as I was saying, it's you know, the rates there are great for the junior doctors. So, look, fundamentally, the hospitals need doctors to survive. And at the moment, you know, they're having to pay a premium. But what I've noticed from that is that more people are open to that line of work. So, you know, this year I've had so many people that ordinarily they just get snapped up in Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane, and you know, they would go straight into their BMO work or their staffy job, and I, you know, they might do 1 week of locums, or you know, and then I'd never hear from them again. But you know, they might refer me people. But this year, like, I've actually worked with quite a few people to do strategic rostering. So I've been like, okay, why don't we do 3 days a fortnight in this hospital, and then, you know, I've gone to the hospital and said, I can guarantee you someone 3 days a week at this rate. You'll never have to advertise, you know. And so there's a bit more strategy now about, rather than sort of the sort of traditional way locuming works, is you would, you know, you would receive a you know, a list of weeks that need covered, and you'd go and work to that list. Now I'm actually more strategic. I'm approaching more hospitals, and, you know, saying,
it sounds like it's this whole flexible work thing is like filtering finally into medicine.
Yeah,
that's what it sounds like. Because like you know what you're saying, like, man, if I didn't already have practice like fairly well established and trying to cut back a little bit, that would be music to my ears. Like, oh, okay, I can flexibly do this. I don't have to wait for leave. Like, I'm going on leave in next month, and it's like getting approved is difficult because everything with short staff. What I wanted to ask is, like, are you noticing people are using locuming to travel? Like, is that still, is that definitely more of a thing that, like, now that rebound travel is meant to be a thing?
No, definitely. And look, I have quite a few doctors that live in overseas. So they'll live in Europe and they come in and they do a bit of work and then they might travel around a bit, then go back. So for example, I've got a guy arriving next week from the UK, and I've got some people from places like Germany and Switzerland. And, you know, I think, there's definitely, as I was saying, more of a inkling to do this sort of flexible working, but it's quite an easy sell at the moment to the doctors because they can choose their own terms, the location. They can pretty much handpick the hospital at the moment. You know, there's pretty much every hospital in Australia is struggling, and you know, they can, as you said, they can use it to finance moving around, and as long as you tie it in with, you know, a certain amount of period, and you know, as long as the hospitals line up, you know, I know people at the moment that are working for us that, you know, I've got someone who's actually moving overseas in June, and they're just literally just going from point to point all the way around Australia, and we you know, we've just planned that with them. So, look, you know,
I don't know if you know, you helped me do that. I don't think I made it clear though when I was working for CareFlight. I did a series of locums up the East Coast that you guys facilitated.
You just
so, yeah, being there, done exactly that, because I was like, could pay for a comm, or I could just work an ICU shift.
But that and that's exactly how you should do it, right? And I think, look, there's no, you know, it's not wrong to do it that way. That's how it should work. And, you know, as I was talking about earlier, we're kind of offering a bit more of a solution now to hospitals than previously. I think before it was a bit more transactional, I would say. And you know, I've always called locum workers, in a weird way, it's a bit like a chess game. You know, you're moving things around and, you know, you create a vacancy by moving someone from some place to the next, and you have to always be thinking one step ahead of what you're actually doing. And I think that is never more true than it, how the market is at the moment. And yeah, look, it's definitely opened a lot of people's eyes to the world of locuming. And I think I've heard from a few people that the WhatsApp groups are sharing a lot of information about people's experience, which is great. That's, you know, that's how it should be. But I also think the hospitals have got very wise about this and they're treating people a lot better. You know, and I think...
One thing I was just going to ask you about is, you know, obviously, you know, the fact that a lot more locums are needed is a problem for hospitals and healthcare system, i.e., it means that, I suppose, on the one hand, you know, maybe doctors just want a bit more time off now, but is there anything that hospitals could be doing to perhaps, you know, attract more doctors to, so they don't necessarily need, you know, temp filling, like, for example, what you're doing by creating, hey, we can guarantee you someone a few days a fortnight, like that sounds like a good thing because at least the hospital has some certainty and it's not just suddenly always filling last minute shifts. Is there anything hospitals could do to try to, you know, help that kind of situation?
Look, I think one thing that I've noticed is, I'm sure you'll remember this, Rafi, and perhaps yourself, Chandra, but the hospitals were very behind, like healthcare just was so behind the times in terms of technology. And I think recently I've noticed there's been a bit of investment into technology. And even recently there's, it's called VaxLinks in New South Wales, or VaxLink, I think it is. So it's basically, it links someone's vaccination record so they're not digging out the paperwork. And I think, look, where this market will go is eventually technology will start being more open across potentially states, but definitely within the states themselves, people won't have to do all the forms. And look, one thing we did when we set up Blueprint was we set up like an e-signing system. So we just used one of like a DocuSign kind of thing. And we put all the hospital forms on there to make it a lot quicker for doctors to fill things in. And actually, once that was really well received, we actually started paying for a software that allowed us to do that, which was hospital specific. And, you know, I think we had to follow the innovation a bit there because other agencies weren't doing that at the time. And I think that's the way that world will have to go. I think that's one thing hospitals should do better. And I think, look, the overall experience for locums these days is much better. I think they're treated a lot better. There's no, I think when I first got into it, locuming used to always almost have like a sort of dirty undertone to it. Like it was not encouraged. You shouldn't do it. You know, it would make your CV look bad.
It attracted a certain crowd as well.
Yeah, for sure.
I could genuinely say that. But I think there's this change, like, I don't know. I think the medical world is built where you're meant to finish and you're meant to go and be a VMO or like, you know, staffy, da, 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 da. But like the training programs are designed so that there is service provision, right? Like the fact is, like as a entire system, we just don't recognize like people who just might not, like the exam starts. Like, don't get me wrong, there's nothing good about it in terms of anything other than getting me knowledge and getting you over a threshold, right? Like, there's all these people with really good experience that could function as a perfect locum, a perfect CMO. And I think the healthcare system just doesn't recognize it. And it just creates all these arbitrary hurdles to make the service provision be a part of the service instead of just going, hey, locuming is just a part of it. This is how it's been for decades. We should just formally acknowledge that this is a suitable and acceptable and a decent career path, right? I feel like that's one of the biggest things that just should happen is like, yeah, if you want to be a CMO, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. That is a career path. It's not a temporary thing. It's just, this could be you. Full stop.
Yeah. And it gives you the flexibility as well. And I think The one area that locoming's become quite strong is, as I said, you know, that flexibility piece is people are drawn to these days. And look, I have doctors working for me most years, but this year I can definitely see a difference in the numbers. But who would be snapped up in a heartbeat in any hospital who just do it for lifestyle reasons, right? They just either they're traveling, they want to, you know, make the most of moving around and having it self-funded, as you were saying. But there definitely is a change in the trend of why people are doing it. And
that, I just feel like it should be the career. Like, it should be acceptable that is the career path that you've chosen. Like, it's not a cop-out. It's just that is the defined thing that you want to do.
I remember South Australia did this thing where they encouraged people as part of their contract to go out to the regional sites. And so it was very well accepted in South Australia that you would do that as part. And look, even, you know, Vic and New South Wales, they do, you know, the regional rotations. But look, the hospitals we work with these days, I think the stigma's changed as well. They're not that regional anymore. You know, the likes of the Gold Coast and Townsville, and you know they're
big centers.
Yeah, they're huge. Yeah, huge. You know, and they're, you know, those kind of places that if you, you know, whatever you want to learn, or you know, if you want to be checking out things like hyperbaric, you know, Townsville is the best place for it, really.
Well, I went and did CareFlight there specifically because it's one of the few places where you had a tertiary level facility, and as a heli medic or whatever, they did all three platforms. So you did international retrievals, you did RFDS, you did local traumas. But you, like, you know, I was there, I was the only responder, no ambulance, nothing, crash site, you manage it, right? And then you transport them not to Brisbane, to Townsville, because it can handle it. It is the only tertiary center out there in the middle of, like, the next place down is Brisbane. And so we were getting patients in from like Papua New Guinea, like this, I remember as you do, a 10-year-old went to hunt, so tried to smoke out an animal. Bushfire went out of control, so he ran up a tree and held on as his back got burnt. Then he walked 10 miles to a village. His uncle was the only one who spoke English, so they went to a fishing village, then went to, like, you know, the series of things that somehow then landed up in a CareFlight jet flying back, and you're like, only stuff you could see out there. Like, this has never happened in the middle of Sydney or Victoria. But it's just a different world.
It's an amazing place. I think, I'm not sure if this is true, but someone told me once their catchment area is, I think it's the size of Germany or something like that.
It would be bigger.
Yeah, I mean,
I absolutely would be bigger, because I have flown people from Isa back to Townsville, and that distance is definitely bigger than Germany.
Yeah, it's, I mean, like, it just puts it into perspective. I don't think people realize, you know, when you go out to these, and the service, and, you know, obviously you're covering everything, you know, there's, you can't turn things away, or the people don't go elsewhere, everyone comes in, you know. So they're very interesting hospitals. And I think, you know, that aside, there's, you know, even some more metropolitan places looking at the moment. It's, you know, it's just a very crazy buoyant market at the moment for new
doctors. Sounds like a really cool experience at, like, hospitals like that. I'm just curious, like, Alex, why do you think hospitals have trouble recruiting people to those kind of things? Because there's a gap, because, you know, they need your help. I'm just wondering, why is it that the hospitals are struggling to attract people?
Look, I think it's a number of things. Like speaking just about my world, I think, obviously the numbers of doctors don't match up to the number of patients. And, you know, that's a fundamental issue. And I think, look, COVID obviously stopped international doctors moving over and moving over so freely. And, you know, we're fortunate enough that the medical systems here are very similar to, you know, Canada, South Africa, the UK, Ireland, New Zealand. I think something's going to have to change. And I think, I noticed obviously the JCCA college, so the Rural Generalist GP Anaesthetist Scheme, is starting to work with ANSCA as well. And I wonder if they'll restructure how they do things in some of the regional sites in terms of anaesthetic.
One of our previous guests, Lahiru, actually just did a sabbatical where his entire thing was to try and help them integrate better. I'm not sure in the full details of it, but yeah, they are starting to actually formally do a bit more training, a bit more up to standard, so that they can pick up some of the slack on like all these places that are struggling a bit.
Yeah, and I think look, there's going to have to be a point where something changes, and it's either going to be the entry requirements. So, you know, either the bachelor's degrees, you know, will become shorter potentially, or, you know, or people will become more rounded potentially. I don't know how they're going to change that part of it, but I know for companies like ourselves, we're trying to pull people from overseas as much as possible. But where I see it going really is, I think, look, healthcare will continue to get bigger. I think, you know, the population is always growing. I think, you know, the regional sites, especially now since COVID, are going to get busier and busier because more people now don't live in the cities. So there is a fundamental problem there. And, you know, let's be honest, most people are drawn to the big cities. So Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane really won't ever, and, you know, and even Perth won't really have a problem attracting people. But it's, you know, something's going to have to give. And
or Adelaide.
I mean, Adelaide in there, but
yeah, Hobart, yeah, those.
But look, I think you know, when we talk to doctors coming from overseas, there's a bit of an educational piece, because I think everyone expects to just rock up and work in Sydney and Melbourne, and you know, then you're sort of trying to, and look, people do end up elsewhere, as we were saying, but you know, there's something's going to have to change. And I think, look, the numbers of doctors, as I said, doesn't match up to the requirements at the moment. So that's a big issue. The other thing is obviously financial pressures. So look, let's be quite brutally honest about this. As great as it is for all of us, with the pay rates going up, the budgets are getting, you know, chewed into. Obviously, the cars are more expensive these days. The accommodations are more expensive. The flights are more expensive. So, you know, you employ a locum in now and it could be double, triple what it used to be. And they may, in some cases, pay more for a locum than a VMO, some of the hospitals. But fundamentally, the staffing issues will always exist.
I can tell you, as someone from the other side who does more like sort of staffy jobs, they are literally looking at locum rates to influence staffy rates now. Like literally 2 days ago, I got a text message about this contract I was about to sign that was totally accidental, but they were looking at the locum rates and they're like, oh, well, we'll just match it. So the hospitals are going the other way to try and use that as the bargaining chip, who has done by a GP anaesthetist. So he's leading the charge on that. So it's interesting world out there. But I think it's coming up to nearly 90 minutes now. So
yeah, sorry, guys.
You've been it's been great, because I mean, come on, you started off with one of the most amazing stories.
Let's get people interested.
But just in terms of closing thoughts, I was just like, well, you've talked a lot about, you know, this full frontal assault from, here you are as a special constable all the way to where you are now running your own company. And it just seems like this brutal sort of 10 plus year grind. What do you do for fun apart from getting punched in the face?
Look, as I was saying, I think for myself, you know, family time's becoming more important. We've got a 2-year-old, we've got a new imminent arrival, so on the 1st of May. So,
oh, wow, very soon.
Yeah, so look, I think for me these days, you know, things are changing. I think, you know, the way I approach work is changing. You know, obviously focusing more on health, you know, trying to, my weekends now are more about getting out, having a swim and, you know, doing things that make me feel good, and that keeps me then energized for the week. But yeah, look, I mean, I'm similar to you, Rafi. I'm not adverse to any travel. I just don't get a chance to do a lot of it these days. Yeah, I think, look, you know, it's great to see parts of the world, and we live in an amazing country, and, you know, there's still things here that I haven't seen. And
you should consider locuming.
I know. Maybe there's be a locum agency for locum agents. Yeah, I'll go and work for some of the other companies for a bit. But yeah, look, I think you know, I think for me things have changed as I've matured and got older. And look, it's fortunately, I'm not out seven nights a week anymore, and, you know, networking and doing all this sort of stuff, it's, you know, it's much more soft for me. It's more about, you know, getting people up to speed. And it's not to say I don't invite people into the office, you know, the people still come in, but gone are the days of me sort of putting myself out there and going out to midnight and, you know, going to the casino in Perth and things like that, which I've definitely done.
There's a casino in Perth?
Yeah.
There is one.
Okay. Oh, yeah, Crown opened, didn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Any questions you wanted to ask, Chandra?
No, I think you covered the important things. I think one of the things I was really curious about, you know, is around that sustainability of work. I mean, there's always going to be a shortfall to fill, but it probably goes up and down all the time.
Yeah, and look, I think because it's driven by the individuals, and I think, as I said, if you take your finger off the pulse a bit, the, you know, the world keeps moving and someone else steps into your shoes. And look, I've been very fortunate to work in the space I have for so long. And, you know, same for Michael as well, having done obstetrics for over 10 years in Australia. It's, you know, it's good for us, but we've seen such changes in that time. And I would never have picked out where things have ended up post COVID. It was just such a, as I've said a few times, it was such a rollercoaster. But, you know, we've all come out the other side. And I think it's, you know, it's interesting to see where business is going. I noticed you guys had a lot of podcasts on AI and, you know, technology.
Yep.
I think that's the kind of thing that will probably end up happening in our world as well, because, you know, with ChatGPT, you can put someone's CV in and, you know, ask it to apply for a certain job, and it will change the CV for the job and, you know, spit out a job spec. And so, you know, for us, I think some of the innovation we're looking at in the future will be things like, you know, getting job specs written by, you know, AI, and, you know, potentially looking at some software that might link in with people's calendars and that sort of thing. So that's the stuff that interests me. That's the nerdy side. You know, I'd love to get involved in a bit more.
All right, we're going to have like a round two where that's all we do. It's okay, looking side aside, let's just talk hardcore nerds topics.
Yeah, exactly.
Couple of random questions then.
Yeah.
Any favorite stories of, like, I mean, okay, I'll start off, but I think I just told you before we started recording, my favorite locoming story. So I just want to know if anyone's shared one or if you've been involved in one. This one you were involved in. So you rang me up going, hey, got this locum lined up. I've already negotiated a beta rate. And at the time, I think I just finished or just about to finish specialty training, and it was literally double everything ever, right? And you're like, yeah, but you got to pack your bags at the flight's in like 6 hours because it was the next morning. I think it was close to midnight or something. I hopped on a plane. I went to Bathurst. And the coolest thing was, like, I think I must have still been a registrar because I think they'd held theaters until I got there. And you're like, yeah, they just need all this emergency stuff cleared. And I cleared it, and I was meant to stay the night. And got to about 4 o'clock, and they were like turning off the theater lights. And I was like, I couldn't even find any other staff. So I rang you going, I know I'm meant to stay, but literally turn things off. And you're like, are you sure? Can you go find the charge? And I'm like, there's no one here. It's getting to be close to pitch black. So you just said, you know, pack up all your bags, head to the airport. I'm like, okay. And I get there, and literally the last passengers just swipe the ticket and they're walking on, and they look at me because I've just hopped out of a taxi. And they're like, yes. I'm like, I had nothing to say. So I rang you again going, what do I do? I don't have a ticket. I don't have anything. And you're like, just get them to refresh. And I was like, okay, he says refresh, and my name appears, and I like walk on like a rock star. And I was like, to this day, it is my favorite locoming story that I tell my registrars. So any great locoming tales that you can come on? Another applause for that.
So things that maybe, I mean, look, the things that happen, like, obviously I'm trying to think of some that are suitable, but just when you think things are going to go smoothly, something happens. And so I was recently, I was having some time off, and I got a call from someone at work, and they said, look, you've sent, you know, one of your locums has got a bit of an issue. And I said, okay, get him to call me or message me. And basically it had gotten checked into an accommodation and found a camera in the corner of the bedroom that wasn't very well hidden, so I'm not sure why it was there. But he was obviously very upset about it. And
what, he didn't want to be an OnlyFans star.
Yeah, yeah. And so I wasn't sure because I'd worked with him a few times, but not many. I wasn't sure if I could get away with it. But when I called him, when I got back, I said, oh, I was, I saw a picture of you on the internet. And luckily he laughed. But yeah, it's just the weird and wacky world of locoming. There's just, honestly, there's things happening all the time like that. But yeah, that's probably the thing that's happened most recently that gave me a bit of a chuckle. But he was very good about it. He was a bit of a trooper about it.
Fair enough. Any other random questions for you, Chandra?
No, nothing much for me.
Okay. Well, anything you'd like to say or any closing remarks, Alex?
I think we obviously spoke a bit about my journey and, you know, how it zigzags a little bit. And I just think, my sort of closing remark for anyone really is, you know, stepping into the business world is even in medicine is don't dwell on the missed opportunities, just see them as a learn and then use that for your future self, because look, you will miss out on things. You will be, second best at times, or, you might not come up with the idea, or someone might steal your idea, but, you just got to see them as learns and move on from them. And I just think, don't dwell on anything, and use it to bounce forward.
Fair enough. That sounds like wise words from someone who's actually, walked the walk and actually launched a company, and that's doing really, really well. So thank you again for doing this. I really like the applause button, if you hadn't guessed.
Yeah, I guess.
That and the womp-womp button.
Yeah, we haven't done that.
Well, it hasn't been sad, right? So for everyone listening, we will have show notes and any links that you'd like, Alex, in there as well, especially to Blueprint and whatnot. And like and subscribe and all that jazz. So for everyone listening, as much as I hate to say it, since Chandra's the Apple guy, I'm more the Android guy. Apple Podcast seems to be where ratings
the most important one.
I have to say it makes a difference there, and on Spotify as well. So yeah, if you do all those things, then we can have more amazing guests like Alex on. So thanks, until guys. Next time, bye-bye.
See you, everybody.